Good afternoon, Capital City and Southeast Alaska listeners. It's almost 3 p.m. It's time for another edition of a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'll be your host for today. On the show, we'll be talking with Sarah Isto and Gordon Harrison about their show of calligraphy and poetry opening this first Friday at the Jack. Brian Weed will be here to highlight his photographs of Juneau history this first Friday at the Red Dog. And we'll talk with Colette Costa about Snowvember films at the Gold Town. Corey Stennett will be here to highlight an upcoming workshop on parenting. Juneau Douglas High School Assistant Principal Kim McNamara will be here to preview Wednesday's Parent Forum on Planning for Success, College and Career Readiness. These guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and some more for Tuesday, November 4th, 2014. Stay with us, and if you haven't voted, there is still time. Get out there and vote. You can't complain later if you didn't.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Voters on the Pine Ridge Reservation are being asked if they want to rename Shannon County. It's named after a Chief Justice of the Dakota Territory Court. Charles Michael Ray has more.
Shannon County takes up most of the Pine Ridge Reservation. South Dakota State Representative Kevin Killer from Pine Ridge is one of those backing the effort to change the name of Shannon County to Oglala Lakota County. Killer says Peter Shannon, the county's namesake, didn't serve Lakota people. Rather, he says, Shannon contributed to the U.S. government's effort to break the 1868 treaty and force Lakotas onto reservations.
He was sent on different delegations, congressional delegations, to work with some of the Lakotas to say, okay, well, if this was to be broken up into individual allotments, how would that look? So, you know, what Shannon did is that he laid the groundwork.
Killer says the ballot issue to change the name of Shannon County to Oglala Lakota County requires a two-thirds majority of county residents. He doesn't want to predict the outcome, but he says he thinks most voters on Pine Ridge are in favor of the name change. He adds that the issue may also increase voter turnout. Killer says to put the name change on the ballot required the petition signatures of 1,800 people, or 15% of registered voters. I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Leaders of two Connecticut tribes say they have no good choices this election. The tribes are state-recognized and say politicians have aligned themselves and lobbied against their efforts to gain federal status. Lucia Duncan reports.
The Shattuckoke Tribal Nation and the Eastern Pequot Nation both won federal recognition in 2004, only to have it taken away a year and a half later. They say it's because Connecticut's congressional delegation appealed the decision by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Richard Velke is chief of the Shattuckoke Tribal Nation. He says the history of his tribe is well documented, and that politicians have turned their backs on the tribes for another reason.
They don't talk about our rights to be federally recognized. They talk about if we're federally recognized, there'll be another casino in the state of Connecticut. Federal recognition is based upon evidence submitted to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and that's where the decision should be rendered.
The BIA has released proposed rule changes to the federal recognition process. One of the changes would clarify that state recognition can, in fact, be considered evidence of a tribe's continued existence. Velke says U.S. Representative Elizabeth Esty, whose campaign the Shattuckoke had supported in 2012, signed a letter objecting to the BIA's proposed rule changes. Esty is running for re-election for a second term to serve Connecticut's 5th District. Velke says his tribe isn't backing any candidates.
We're so discouraged. Every time we go ahead and campaign for other individuals, we feel that we're going to get at least a fair shake, a discussion. But once they're in office, they just turn their back towards us.
Dennis Jenkins is chair of the Eastern Pequot Nation, the other Connecticut tribe stripped of its federal recognition. Jenkins says his tribe sent letters to politicians asking for support for the BIA rule change, but didn't get any response.
We're going to fight until the last breath we have. We know who we are, and they know who we are. You know, we've been around before Connecticut was here. The fight is going to continue.
Jenkins says he expects the new regulations to come out in the next few months or early next year, and that they're likely to be contested in court. As for this election, voters will also be choosing Connecticut's next governor. Jenkins says he will cast a ballot, but is undecided who he will pick in the governor's race. Both Jenkins and Velke predict a small turnout from their tribes because they say none of the politicians represent their interests.
That was Lucia Duncan reporting, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
3:05 p.m., and my first guests in the studio are Sarah Isto and Gordon Harrison, and they're going to be talking about poetry and calligraphy. All right, how are both of you today?
Fine.
Thank you.
Okay, and how did you get involved with this shared interest? Because both of you are married to each other, how did you connect up the poetry and calligraphy?
It came quite independently. My interest in calligraphy started several years ago, well before Sarah started writing poetry. And I've been working at it, and she started writing poetry, and that gave me something to work with. So it was fortuitous.
All right. And Sarah, how long have you been writing poetry?
Well, probably only for a couple of years. After I retired, I wrote two nonfiction books. And then I was ready to work with something shorter and maybe a little more creative. And so a couple of years ago, I started writing poetry. And then Gordon picked up some of the pieces and used them for practice. And
here we are.
Here we are.
All right. Well, a little background on calligraphy for those people who don't know. It's fancy writing. Is what
beautiful
it is.
Writing.
All right. And calligraphy began before the Greeks, and it was prevalent throughout Latin script, especially in conveying religious materials throughout the years. And then the Chinese picked it up in the mid-6th century, and they started using it pretty much for the same purposes, but they got a little bit more, let's say, fancy with, you know, the backgrounding that they would use. And, you know, they looked like they were very interested in the entire composition as far as, you know, the image used behind it, the placement of the characters that they were, you know, writing in script. So, I mean, it's had a really wide history through China and also through a lot of the Latin areas, you know, as far that's basically where it started, as well as some of the Middle East countries, too, are pretty big on this. So did either of you know how prevalent it was before you started getting into it?
Oh, vaguely, I guess. Western calligraphy really flourished in the Middle Ages, and those pieces were also lavishly illustrated. They would have scribes and teams of illustrators, and manuscripts of just astounding beauty were produced in the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th centuries, and we're still using scripts today. Scripts I'm using are slightly modernized versions of scripts that were developed in the 9th century.
All right, Gordon. And what gets you to select a certain style for a certain piece?
I mean, if a piece is lighthearted, clearly you want something informal and a little bouncy and so on. If it's more solemn, a more subdued, even a Gothic black letter script or something. But that's a fairly easy thing to do. Try to match the script with the tone and the sense of the poem.
And how did you start out with an interest in calligraphy? I mean,
kids
have like little stencils that they can use to do
it. I have no idea. I've had a terrible scrawl handwriting all my life, but it's always struck me as something of great beauty. And I just was drawn to it, and I can't explain it, but it's been very engaging and fun, and that's the bottom line.
All right, so Gordon, if you're responsible for the lettering, and Sarah, you're responsible for the poetry, who picks the backgrounding?
Well, I do, and that's a very difficult part of doing a piece of finished calligraphy, and all the backgrounds in these pieces are quite modest and simple. In large part, I don't want to overshadow or detract in any way from the poetry, but that's partly making a virtue out of necessity. I'm not a skilled illustrator or watercolor artist, so the backgrounds are fairly simple and subtle, but they're always suggested by the poem itself.
And do you also do those yourself?
I do those myself, yes.
All right, Sarah, do you have any input in that whatsoever? Have you come across a piece and said, hey, it'd be really nice with the, this poem that I've got, I'm thinking of, and you come to Gordon with that idea?
No, we work fairly independently. Gordon will look through poems that I'm working on and see something that interests him or that he likes and would like to work with. And then he works with it, and it isn't until I see the finished product that I realize what he's done. And it is true that sometimes when I'm writing, I see a poem in a certain shape or something like that, and perhaps I see it in an inverted triangle, and when Gordon finishes with it, it turns out it's in an arc. You know, our visions are different, but we work independently. I wait to see what he's going to produce.
Okay, this question's for either of you for your first Friday presentation at the Jack. How many pieces are you going to have on display?
I think we have counted 31.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some oddball pieces, pieces on printed on cloth and so on. But most of them are framed pieces of work on paper.
And what would be your largest one that you've done?
Well, there's an unframed one there that must be close to 30 inches square or mm-hmm. 35 inches square or something.
All right. It also says that you're going to do some poetry and calligraphy workshops. Why don't you tell everybody about those?
Well, we each have a session planned, and it's not really a workshop. My session is on Wednesday, November 12th at 7:30 at the Jack. And I'm calling it a conversation. I don't want to give a lecture, and I'm not going to give any instruction or anything like that. But I want to say something about calligraphy, and I'll have some slides to illustrate things that have been done in the past and some things that are being done today by calligraphers, some really beautiful, beautiful pieces, contemporary work. It's quite popular and the lower 48. I mean, there's a revival, an interest in calligraphy. And then I just want to answer questions and maybe encourage people to pick up a pen.
Do the two of you have a website at all?
Sarah has a website for her two books.
But that's for my books, not for my poetry.
Okay, so maybe you're going to integrate
that.
No, we don't have one.
Okay. And let's highlight again where your showing is going to be and when.
Okay, the showing is at the Jack. It'll be there be up all month of September.
November.
November, excuse me. Now, Sarah also has a reading that she should talk about.
All right, Sarah, let's have it.
on the 17th of November, there's going to be a poetry reading. And we'll have six or seven poets from Juneau who are involved with poetry in different ways in Juneau, Emily Wall from the university and others. And each person will talk a little bit about their involvement and read 5 minutes of poetry. It's in the evening at 7 o'clock. The gallery will be open. There will be refreshments and we're encouraging anyone who enjoys hearing poetry to come to that.
And Sarah, this will also be at the Jack, correct?
That's also at the Jack, yes.
All right. Sarah Isto, Gordon Harrison, thank you very much for being our guests on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Programming support on KTOO is provided by Silver Bow Bakery and Catering, announcing ready-to-serve Thanksgiving meals for 8 to 12 people or half orders serving 4 to 6, ready for pickup and eat Thanksgiving Day. Silver Bow Catering, accepting Thanksgiving orders at 586-4146.
My next guests on the show are Brian Weed and Joe McCabe, and Brian and Joe are here to highlight his Photographs of Juneau History, which is going to be presented Friday at the Red Dog, is that right?
Right, the Red Dog from 4 to 8 p.m.
Okay, tell us a little bit about the historic photographs that we've got.
Well, our group's called Juneau's Hidden History, and we specialize in taking pictures of historical relics and ruins from about 1945 and older. And this art showing is going to be comprised of a slideshow that's going to run 25 minutes long. There's no commentary with it, but it's going to show what it looks like in the mine tunnels today. I've been to 246 different tunnels in the Juneau area, and you're going to see about one or two pictures from each tunnel I've been to.
Okay, I've got somebody that I work with who said he's been up the one at off of Perseverance Trail, and he said there was like a huge room in there that has such a high ceiling he couldn't even see the top of it.
So, right. There's a huge stoat in the AJ mine. It's about the size of a football field, complete with, you know, like if you combine the bleacher section also, almost like the Floyd Dryden track. And the room's mostly flooded. I don't have any photos from that. It'd probably be pretty hard to because you wouldn't have the flash equipment to light
right.
it up.
Right. It's a huge room, so it's like near impossible to do without bringing in floodlights.
Right.
All right, and why do you think that we've forgotten about a lot of this stuff?
A lot of the mines get buried over the course of the years. There's landslides, rock slides. Some of them cave in. The Bureau of Land Management in the 80s did samples and tested these mines to see if they were worth reopening. But back in the 80s, they didn't have GPS. So you have a couple of guys on the hill that are surveyors, and they say, we're right about here on this map. Well, right about here on the map could be a half mile to a quarter mile off.
That's the no GPS back then.
Yeah. And when you're talking about a half mile on the side of, you know, Mount Roberts, that's a big deal.
That's a large area to have to look for a little hole going into the mine. All right. Is there some identifiable person or agency that's responsible for the majority of the photos? Like, do we know who was taking the pictures back then?
Well, the pictures taken back in the day in the 80s, Earl Redmond did a lot of the photos. And he was recently in town for my last First Friday event. He's currently living in Ireland. And he was just in town on a fluke and happened to come to the show last First Friday. I'm following his work and read his book years ago and have been following it ever since.
But the pictures in Brian's show are all from By Brian.
Okay.
Recent photos by Brian.
Yep. Okay. And why do you think that we have a lot of the historical photos of Juno that in a lot of ways show disasters and things that happened back then? There are not a lot of really good ones. I mean, there's some of them for prominent historical figures, and we've got some old glacier photos and stuff, but I mean, it looks like all the only ones we've got, like, you know, like here's a fire on Douglas Island and stuff. Things burnt down.
It's what made the news, just like today, war, shooting, stuff like that. That's what sold newspapers, the big headline. There were very few cameras here, 1930 and older. Around 1910, where most of these small mines operated, there was only probably two cameras here in Southeast Alaska. So unless you had a big mine or you had a big incident, no one was taking pictures of those areas. So there are no pictures of these small mines.
I imagine that nobody even had developing equipment here. We probably had to put it on a ship and send it elsewhere to get developed and printed.
Right. Well, and I'm also showing about 19 pieces of art, and they're mounted on old rusty plates full of bullet holes, and they have some copper wire holding them up for artistic purposes. But the pictures themselves are from the East and West Glacier area. There was an old CCC camp from the 1930s over by Skater's Cabin. There was an old federal repair garage, and there was a 1,000-yard rifle range on that west side. Also up on the hill, there was a small mine called the Mendenhall Prospect, which operated in 1897. And those cabin ruins are still there, along with one small tunnel still open on that side.
And the terrific thing is all these places are very easy to get to, right off the trails. That's kind of what Brian's trying to highlight a little bit, is all this stuff is pretty much right there. We've been walking by it for years.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are out there that, you know, hey, here's the entrance to a mine over here.
It's fascinating.
And, nobody's been paying attention to it. So in actuality, you're bringing a lot of the past history up to the present and reminding people that, hey, these things are still out there.
Right. And I'm trying to show them why the trails are there. In most cases, these trails are here because of mining. The East Glacier Trail exists because there was an AJ power plant alongside the highway out to the glacier. And that power plant, you can follow the pipe all the way up the hill to Nugget Creek, the big falls alongside the glacier. And there's a dam up there that's still there today. The pipe's not working. The power plant's gone. But you can follow the old pipes. You can see the old water tunnel that came from behind the dam. There's an old pump still there, and the pump's as big as a car. And it's just off the trail on East Glacier, and you wouldn't even know it if you didn't know where to look.
All right, Brian, how did you first get interested in this?
Well, my father worked in Douglas, and he worked for DOT in the old, well, I guess it's Fish and Game building now. And in the summer times, he would bring me to Douglas and drop me off and say, be back, 3:30. And that's when I'm leaving. And I would run around Sandy Beach and go way out there and explore the mine tunnels out there and see the old mine ruins and kind of stray off the trail and run as fast as I could back to the parking lot to be there at 3:30 again.
Wow. That was back in the old days when parents would actually say, get lost, do something.
Yeah, they wouldn't do that today.
Now they kind of frown on that today.
Yeah.
Somebody report you for being a delinquent. All right. So the Friday show is going to consist of the slides and then
I'll
the
have
pieces
some art,
that you have
art
mounted.
On display.
Okay.
The Red Dog, a lot of people don't know they serve food. They're going to have dinner. They have pretty good appetizers. I like their nachos. Have a beer, watch the slideshow. It's 25 minutes long. What's that, a beer or two?
That's all right. Give them a plug. That's fine. And is there any is the Red Dog's not charging a fee for admission for this?
They are not, no.
Okay, so it's just come on in, have a beer, have something to eat, and see the show.
And watch the show, yeah.
Okay. And Joe, is there anything else that you wanted to add?
No, people should come out. It's really fascinating. I got involved with this, I guess, last April. I've been going out with Brian a ton, and it's if anybody's bored just wandering around the regular trails, hook up with Brian and go out with him and see what's all around you never knew about.
Okay, and one last thing I wanted to add is there been any of the mine tunnels that you've gone into where you've gotten lost or you were afraid of getting lost in there?
No. If I ever find a mine that I get lost in, that would be an amazing mine.
Then we'll...
I would be excited
we'll be
if I ever got lost
still be
in a
lost.
Mine somewhere.
All right. Well, I wish you the best of luck with your presentation on Friday. That's going to be at the Red Dog. And what time is that going
to
be?
From 4 to 8 p.m. The last showing of the slideshow will start at 7:30.
All right. Brian Weed, Joe McCabe, thanks for being our guests on the show.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 4th of November, 2014. It's the birthday of the poet C.K. Williams, born Newark, 1936, good basketball player, 6'5", recruited to play in college. And then, trying to impress a girl, he wrote a poem, and she was actually impressed, and so he decided to be a poet instead, dropped out of college, moved to Paris. He thought a poet ought to live in Paris. He didn't write anything while he was there, but he did realize that probably he should go back to college. He said, "It was an incredibly important time. Not much happened, and yet my life began then. I discovered the limits of loneliness." It was on this day in 1899 Sigmund Freud's book, The Interpretation of Dreams, was first published. It came out in a run of 600 copies, and it was not a big success. It took 8 years to sell out. The scientific journals of the day all ignored the book, except for psychology journals, and they gave it bad reviews. In the book, Sigmund Freud argued that dreams represented a way for the unconscious to work out conflicts between the id, the superego, and the ego. The id, driven by the pleasure principle, wanting instant gratification, the ego operating on the reality principle, translating the demands of the id in socially acceptable ways, and the superego, the conscience, which tries to suppress the id. But the id has to express itself somehow, and it does this in dreams. The fact that scientific journals did not notice his writing did not trouble Freud deeply. He said, "I'm a scientist by necessity and not by vocation. I am really by nature an artist, and psychoanalysis has been better understood and applied by writers and artists than by doctors. My books more resemble works of imagination than treatises on pathology." It's the birthday of Will Rogers, born near Aluga, Oklahoma in 1879, star Broadway, and about 70 movies, wrote 6 books, and his newspaper column, Will Rogers Says, reached 40 million readers. It was on this day in 1918, the British poet Wilfred Owen was killed in World War I at the age of 25, just a week before the end of the war. He was trying to get his men across a canal in Belgium, and they were attacked by enemy fire, and he was fatally wounded. And it was on this day in 1922 that a British explorer, Howard Carter, in Egypt, looking for the tombs of royalty, opened a sealed door and walked into a dark chamber and saw shadowy figures of statues and gold, everything in the glint of gold. It was the tomb of King Tut, King Tutankhamun. Here's a poem for today by Harvey Shapiro, entitled Book Group. We read a book ostensibly about the Holocaust, in which 6 million were killed, babies had their skulls bashed against the wall, an entire culture was wiped out, leaving only the vaudeville Jews of America. And the critic in the group says the theme is survival, and everyone cries, "Paradox, paradox." Book Group, a poem by Harvey Shapiro, from his collection A Momentary Glory, published by Wesleyan University Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity. introducing a 10-minute FIT test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Juno Arts and Humanities Council invites you to experience the work of internationally acclaimed poet and storyteller, Ke Aloha, the first poet laureate of Hawaii, on Saturday, November 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Jack. Ke Aloha is the founder of Hawaii Slam, Youth Speaks Hawaii, and First Thursdays, the largest registered slam poetry event. Come and experience the power of spoken word. Tickets available at jahc.org.
3:30 p.m. A Juno afternoon continues, and when we get to 4 o'clock, we're not going to All Things Considered like we normally do. We'll be getting on to breaking news in order to bring you the latest in the election results, because the East Coast of the United States polls are going to be closing at 4 o'clock our time. So, we'll see what happens there. My next guests on the show are Chris Miller and Sandy Miller, and they're here to talk about the Gold Town's Snowvember films that are coming up. And they're all a ski movie series, right?
Correct.
That's right.
Okay, let's talk about them.
Okay, well, thanks for having us, Ken.
You're welcome.
For starters, so this is our second annual Snowvember film series that we've put on. Last year was obviously the first year. This year we're really excited. We've got 6 really cool films that we're showing. This Wednesday will be our third showing of Trial and Error, which is a smaller film production company called White Room Productions out of Austria. And we're showing that Wednesday night at 7 p.m. But really the format of the whole thing is really simple to remember. We have film showing every Saturday at 2 p.m. and 9 p.m. and then Wednesdays at 7 p.m. So then this Saturday we'll be showing Days of Our Youth, which is by Matchstick Productions. The following Saturday, November 15th, we're showing Snow Guardians, which is a really interesting documentary on the ski patrollers and mountain rescue folks in the Bridger Bowl in Montana area. And then we're really excited for Ladies Night, which we're showing on November 22nd. We have 2 films. It's a double feature, and they're both all female casts. So it's really cool. So we have Pretty Faces and Pure. And then the final film that we'll be showing is on November 29th by Absinthe Productions called Heavy Mental.
All right, Chris, Sandy, who selects the films that you're going to present?
It's both of us, and then kind of partner up with Colette Costa from the theater.
And run times for all of these, are they?
Ooh, good question.
They're all roughly about an hour for the most part. The longest will be our Ladies' Night with Pretty Faces and Pure, because they're both, I think, Pretty Faces is about 50 minutes and Pure is about 45, give or take. And we'll have an intermission in between. And then the other fun thing, too, is that on Saturday nights, we have beer donated by Alaskan Brewing. So we'll be selling beer and wine, and that's catered by Louis over in Douglas. So it's really kind of, it's a community event. We have a ton of local sponsors that kind of pitch in, and we really couldn't do it without all of them.
Okay, so this is your second series. What did we run last year that was a standout?
I'd say End of the Mine by Sherpa Films. That was a good one. And then Valhalla that probably drew the biggest crowd.
And since both of you have previewed the films that will be running this session here, which one is your favorite?
Personally, I'm really looking forward to Days of Our Youth, but I mean all of them.
Okay, and Chris?
Yeah, you know, I think for me, Pretty Faces and Pure, both of those, because they are both, they're the two first large production, all-female cast ski movies. I mean, you know, females traditionally are involved in ski movies, so it's really exciting to have that and them featured in these two films.
Well, and the first one is going to take place at the Gold Town when again?
The first one, actually, we already started. We started November 1st.
Okay, it already happened.
It's already beginning, so it's every Saturday for the whole month. But we'll tomorrow at 7 p.m. we'll be screening Trial and Error. This will be the last showing of that film, and then Saturday we'll start. We'll be showing Matchstick Productions' Days of Our Youth.
All right. And anything either of you two would like to add?
I guess I'd really like to highlight the fact that we do have all these local sponsors, and without the support of local businesses and local sponsors, we really couldn't put on events like this. And there are so many businesses that support events in this community.
Similar
to ours.
Oh, sure. Go ahead and plug them.
Yeah, exactly.
Who are we talking about?
let me read off the whole list here because we really couldn't do it without all of them. So we've got the Aurora Project, the Rookery Cafe, Alaskan Brewing, who I already mentioned, AK Reuse, Art Such Photography and Digital Imaging, Alaska Powder Descents, Louise Douglasin, Foggy Mountain Shop, Sequence Board Shop, of course, Eagle Crest Ski Area, and then one of our favorite radio stations, KXLL.
All right. Now that's one of our sister ones here.
Exactly.
All right. Chris Miller, Sandy Miller, thank you very much for being our guests on the show.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Thanks for having us.
Good luck with the film series.
Yeah, we hope to see everyone there.
And I should have played this at the end of the last segment here, but I didn't. So here's a little bit of Devo's Working in the Coal Mine. It's actually featured on the 1981 heavy metal soundtrack. That was Devo's Working in a Coal Mine. We didn't have a Working in the Gold Mine song, so I kind of had to improvise just a little bit there. And my next guest is Corey Stennett, and she's the Community Outreach Educator with Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest.
Yeah, thanks.
Did I get that?
You got it. You got it right.
All right, that's a long title. I wonder how you put that on a placard on the door. That'd be tough. All right, and you're here to talk about the Let's Talk Parent Workshop, which is coming up tomorrow night.
I am, yeah. We've offered several of these in the community and really want to offer it again this fall. And it's a great chance for parents or caregivers of youth, really, to come and get some support on starting and continuing the conversation.
All right. We're not going to beat around here. Let's talk about what it is. It's sex and reproduction.
It is. It's a healthy sexuality conversation. So, and we know that it's not just having one conversation is not what is most effective in supporting our teens or our youth as they're growing up. So really what we want to do is help give parents some skills, some strategies, just some support, some practice space for talking about what can be some pretty tough topics around sexual health, around sexuality development, around supporting our kids and strategies to be able to say no, to wait, to understand, you know, what's going on in this development as they become young adults.
Yeah, a lot of them, I don't think, are really skilled on opening a dialogue with their children and saying, hey, you know, the last thing they want to be perceived of is like, this is what mom and dad do behind closed doors.
Right.
It's like, oh, my God, my parents do it. I just can't believe that happens.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, on the upside, the good news is that we know that a lot of parents are trying to have these conversations and are doing a good job. And even this summer, Planned Parenthood and the New York University's Center for Latino Adolescent and Family Health surveyed a wide array of parents to kind of find out who's talking about what. And we find out that about 80% of parents are having some kind of conversations with their kids about sexuality and about relationships. And that's great. And that means we want to help that other 20% have conversations. It also means we want to help parents, you know, be able to have really specific conversations. So even though some of these conversations are happening, some of the topics aren't, it's not translating specifically to the kids' understanding. So, yeah.
Do you think that this plays into when kids say, well, my parents just don't understand me, and then the parent says, you know something, this is a story, this is what happened to me, and at that time, I felt nobody understood me either. And does that, in a lot of ways, help bridge the gap for parents?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can just be a really challenging topic, and that lack of, you know, misunderstanding or lack of understanding or not realize, you know, some youth and teens not realizing, hey, their parents have been here before and have gone through some similar things. I think that can just create a real
divide. I think parents from the
dawn
of time have gone through all this before. But yeah. And how is there any instruction given to parents to cope with the tremendous amount of information and imagery that comes at their kids every day?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the biggest things is to try to use that imagery, use what we're inundated with as talking points with kids. So one of the things that Planned Parenthood recently created was a TV teen parent talk guide. So it's really looking at what are we seeing in the media, what are we seeing on TV, and using those opportunities to try and connect with kids, to start to have little openings to conversations and to keep those conversations going, because like we're inundated. It's all around us all the time. So instead of, you know, being just affected by that, to try to use that to connect.
Not only when we were growing up, wasn't it 24/7? Because yeah, you know, we did not have the huge advent of information that we've got now between 24-hour television, internet on 24 hours that you can get to at any time from just about anywhere. I mean, we had stuff like Gilligan's Island and Bewitched and things like that. You know, it's like, yeah, and it showed, in a lot of cases, until we got into a little bit further along in the television era, we had people that were shown in separate beds a lot, too.
Yeah, and really different.
Yeah, it's way different. Yeah. And all the humor was geared differently than what we've got now, too.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And just all the more reason the kids these days just have access to so much information in different ways, and they're going to seek it out, whether it's from their peers, whether it's on the internet. They're going to seek out information And for parents' voice not to be a part of that, you know, for parents not to take that opportunity to try to reach out to their kids and connect in that space. No, in a way that their values can come through, that they can express their, you know, their wants for their kids. It's just a missing link if we don't take that opportunity to talk with our kids about that.
That's tragic. Because, you know, in the availability of such easy information, you would think the easiest thing to do is for a parent and a child to talk together.
Yeah, but it's not easy
on that topic, though. It's easy to talk about what we're having for dinner, but it's a little bit harder to open the door for some of the other topics.
Right. And, you know, especially with some of the reactions that parents may get from their kids. I mean, from hands going over the ears,
I don't
like,
hear
no,
it,
don't talk to me about that. I mean, but the voices of parents really do travel through to their kids, even if it doesn't seem like it in the moment. And, you know, that's why we suggest sometimes, you know, in the car where you're not having to have full-on eye contact talking about these things can be helpful. Having books around the house that are books that parents have reviewed that are resourceful, that, you know, so that you're creating a direct connection with some of that information that you really want your kids to have, in addition to hopefully having, you know, the verbal conversations.
Do you think that we as parents lose that over time? Because it's kind of like, well, you're talking with your child all the time as they're growing up, you're passing on information to them. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, after a while, you kind of take the training wheels off of it and you let them go a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then we get out of the, you know, of that communicative process with the kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can, and I think it can be helpful sometimes to remember that asking questions can be a really great way to start that off, so that we're not, you know, we're asking questions, we're interested in what they're doing, we're finding out who they're hanging out with and where they're going, and I think a lot of parents do, you know, a lot of parents are doing that and doing really great jobs at it, but figuring out how to have those conversations that aren't just us, you know, telling our kids, do this, don't
do
that.
Hey, don't do this. I did this, and look what happened to me. Yeah.
But actually, you know, connecting and trying to have the connection conversations and asking questions and trying not to judge. I mean, kids are going to ask questions, and it doesn't always mean that they're doing the behaviors about the questions they're asking. They need to know that they can go to a trusted source to get information, and that I think that's a really important role that we can play as parents. So,
do you find that other adults or people that like are good friends or neighbors are an equivalent source for the parents, because maybe a child would be more comfortable talking to somebody that they kind of know but don't have so much of a history of as with their own parents?
Yeah, I think that can be really powerful to have trusted adults in kids' life other than the parents to be able to ask these questions to or just, you know, have the conversations with. So I think that's critical. I mean, we hope that all kids have multiple other trusted adults in their lives. So
and mentors too.
And mentors. Yeah.
That's really important, because I relied on one extensively when I was going through school, because I had two parallel paths that I could have gone on.
Yeah.
But wound up getting interested in aviation because of one guy that was, you know, basically he ran a ground instruction flight school and, you know, also did, you know, flight training. And he sort of guided me along, and I was able to make some really good choices for career path because of him.
Nice. Yeah.
I mean, not everybody's got that.
No, but I sure wish we did. And the power of just supporting kids and finding their path as he did with you. I mean, that's really powerful. It's taking care of each other. It's supporting each other in our journeys and in our pathways. And we are not really going to be able to escape this, you know, sexual development pathway through puberty, through teenagerdom, through, you know, taking responsibility for decisions that affect our lives, our relationships, our health. So
Well, Corey, your face really lights up with this topic, and you seem like you're very confident, and you're a good outreach presenter. I can just tell that you are. So let's go over a little bit now of when and where this discussion is going to take place, the Let's Talk Parent Workshop.
Yes, so it's happening tomorrow night. That's November 5th from 5:45 to 8:15 p.m. at the Juno Family Health and Birth Center. So we'll be meeting down in the downstairs classroom where the library is there in the Birth Center. And that's at 1601 Salmon Creek Lane up by Valley Medical, kind of back behind where the search building is, over near the hospital area. And, you know, I know sometimes people are like, what? That is a whole evening. That's a really long time. And I want to read a quote that I actually have on the flyer in front of me that says, "A good informative program that kept my attention the whole time. I was not really ready to leave when it ended." And that was from a Juno parent participant. So we've had quite a few parents from our local community, you know, participate in this workshop over the last couple of years. And you get really good feedback that it has helped them have these conversations and to keep them going, to keep the conversation going.
Corey, you've even got testimonials. I love that.
I know.
All right. Corey Stennett, thank you very much for being our guest on the show today, and good luck with your Let's Talk Parent
Can
workshop.
Can I jump in
one
more thing? One more thing I wanted to add is if you would like more information, you can feel free to give me a call at 209-7051. And there is a suggested donation of $10. And parents or caregivers who come will walk away with a folder full of some really great resources. So just want to let folks know that. So 5:45 to 8:15 tomorrow night.
All right, and if they get embarrassed to talk to you on the phone, there is actually some email that you've got too. So
I do. It's a really, really long one, just like my title here. So that email is my name, Corey, so Corey.Stennett, S-T-E-N-N is in Nancy, E-T-T. At ppgnw.org, so that's as in Planned Parenthood, Great Northwest. So Corey.Stennett at ppgnw.org.
All right, Corey, absolutely a pleasure having you on the show today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This is Bird Note. Around this time of year, common mergansers are flying south from Canada to wintering grounds in the lower 48. What dictates when they decide to go? These ducks, like most birds, are well insulated against frigid winter temperatures. But they do have to find food, and they can only find their fishy prey by diving below the surface in open bodies of water. So they're doing just fine, resting and feeding in southern Canada, until they wake up one November morning and a thin veneer of ice is forming on their lake. That ice is a sign of the times, and enough to let the ducks know they should be heading south. This makes common mergansers and some other diving ducks among the last of the migrants to appear in the U.S. in late fall. In years to come, if they start to arrive later, it may be a sign that changes in climate are shaping their migratory behavior. Read the latest reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to see why those mergansers may not be coming south in the future. This show was written by BirdNote's science advisor, Dennis Paulson. Other writers include Bob Sundstrom, Ellen Blackstone, Gordon Oriens, and Francis Wood. BirdNote's producer is John Kessler, and I'm Mary McCann.
Programming support on KTOO is provided by Silver Bow Bakery and Catering, announcing ready-to-serve Thanksgiving meals for 8 to 12 people or half orders serving 4 to 6. Ready for pickup and eat Thanksgiving Day. Silver Bow Catering, accepting Thanksgiving orders at 586-4146.
3:53 p.m., and you're listening to KTOO in Juneau. My last guests today on the show are Juneau Douglas High School Assistant Principal Kim McNamara and also Jennifer Nagg. They're here to preview Wednesday's Parent Forum on Planning for Success. Welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
We wanted to come and promote our parent forums that are happening four times this year. We already had one that went off without a hitch in the fall that was on social media safety. And our next one is tomorrow for Planning for Success, College and Career Readiness. Jennifer is going to talk about that in just a couple of minutes. We also have one in January that's called Not My Teen Drug and Alcohol Awareness. And then the last one for this year will be April 8th. And it's Arrive Alive, a parent-teen workshop about the dangers of distracted and impaired driving. So we wanted to start these parent forums this year as a way to get parents getting into the school in a different fashion. And we had lots of input from parent groups, our parent group at JDHS, our site council, a community and schools organization that we have in our school, and then some student groups. And they provided input to us as far as what topics would be good ones for parents to focus on and to have a chance for them to talk to local experts, express their frustrations, come up with some solutions, just sort of, you know, get that conversation going. Our first one, as I said, was a great success. We are gearing it towards parents, but students are welcome to come. So I'm going to pass off to Jennifer here, who will talk about specifically our forum that is tomorrow, 5:30 to 7 in the JDHS library.
Great. All right, Jennifer, you're up.
Awesome. So I'm one of two school counselors at JDHS, and the other school counselor, Barbara Conant, and I are kind of leading the tomorrow night's forum. It's very exciting. It's a way for us to engage parents and how to look beyond the academics on how to get their kids successful and ready. We have a few different pieces to the puzzle coming together. We will have a parent panel of parents who have had students be successful in getting into college and talking about what that really looks like, you know, the real world application. We're also very lucky that admissions rep from Pacific Lutheran University, as well as our admissions people from UAS, are going to drop by and also participate a little bit. So it's super exciting. Yeah.
All right, Jennifer. And let's remind people that may not know this, but as of this last July, just a couple of months ago, all grade 11 students in Alaska must take a college or career readiness assessment.
Yes.
So how is that working out, since that's like kind of brand new enacted law here?
Well, it is. It's brand new, but it's nothing that isn't, I mean,
well, we were taking the SAT and the ACTs before.
So it gives extra opportunity for some of our students who may not have taken those tests in the past to have that opportunity because the state will pay for it. In the past, the last couple of years, all our juniors had taken the Workies assessment. Now it just kind of transitions that over. It's kind of difficult to get the juniors in the mindset that I have to pick one of these tests because they just passed the high school qualifying exam that no longer exists. So we're kind of working on getting them all settled in, picking a test. It's a very exciting time, but also one where, as a school system, we're trying to figure out what it looks like, right? So things are just coming down from the state of how they're going to look. But our kids are excited about it. They're talking about it. Our parents are stressed out about it, but it's a good thing, and we're very excited for it.
Yeah, big picture, it provides some more choice for families, whether their child is ready for college or looking more in the vocational areas, gives some more choices.
All right, Kim, and let's remind everybody where the college and career readiness presentation is going to take place.
JDHS Library at 5:30 to 7.
And that is tomorrow night.
Correct. Wednesday.
Not tonight, because tonight everybody's supposed to be out voting if they're eligible and of age.
That's right. It was very exciting today at school. A bunch of our teachers went before school and they were wearing their I voted stickers, kind of role modeling that good civil engagement.
Nice.
Civic engagement.
I got it in early. I went about 10 days ago and voted over at the Mendenhall Mall. It was easy, quick, hardly anybody there. So it was
exciting.
Yeah, well, we're going to be going to breaking news in about another 2 minutes to find out what the election results start coming in at, because the East Coast polls are going to be closing here in just about 90 seconds. So we may start getting a little bit of preliminary results coming in through breaking news. Kim, anything else you want to add before I let you go?
Just please come and join us for our parent forum tomorrow.
All right. Everybody show up at JDHS if you got a kid that's getting ready for college. And let's get into the forecast for tonight. We're expecting rain showers with lows dropping into the upper 30s and east winds at 10 to 15. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, becoming locally windy with a chance of rain. Highs around 43 and southeast winds at 10 miles an hour, increasing to northeasterly at 15 to 25 with gusts around 40 in the afternoon near downtown Juneau and Douglas. Boy, does it sound like a repeat of what we just had. And then Thursday, numerous rain showers with highs in the low 40s and southeast winds at 10 to 20. Thursday night, rain likely. Well, at least we didn't see the dreaded S word show up. It's all the R's right now. All right, and you're listening to KTOO in Juneau. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. And we also broadcast on K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, digital channel 871. KRNN is on 872 and KXLL is 873. We are also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the wonderful listeners like you. I'm Ken Fix. I've been your host for today. I'll see you again next Tuesday, but right now, let's go to breaking news for some election results.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of Election Night 2014. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The GOP is in the hunt for control of the Senate. And NPR projects that in West Virginia, Republican Shelley Moore Capito has picked up one of those Senate seats.
And another projection, Republican Mitch McConnell of Kentucky.